We see the temptations to which his clouded reason was exposed. Good and evil were in a fair way to be thoroughly confused in his mind. There were moments when he was tempted to interpret evil as good. The symbol coming after lie on the slip of paper was calculated, thanks to the mummy on it, to open his eyes to the kingdom whence the temptation came, and to show him that to yield to it would be an unpardonable affront toward him who was no mummy god promising endurance and nothing else, but rather a god of the future. Yet even so, Joseph had every ground to mistrust the strength of his seven reasons, and the course which future feast hours would take, and to lend an ear to the whisperings of a certain little friend who implored him to go no more to the mistress, to receive no more billet doux from the malicious go-between, and to fear the bull which even now was beginning to turn the smiling meadow into a field of ashes with his fiery breath. True, for Joseph to avoid the mistress was more easily said than done. After all, she was the mistress, and when she called, he had to go. But how prone is man to keep open the door to evil choice, rejoicing in freedom and playing with fire. Whether out of self-confidence that thinks it can take the bull by the horns, or out of light-headedness and secret desire, who can tell? The Painful Tongue, Play and Epilogue. There came that night, in the third year, when Mut-Em-Enit, Potiphar's wife, bit her tongue, because it so overpoweringly craved to say to her husband's young steward that which she had already written to him in a rebus, while at the same time her pride and shame would have prevented her tongue from speaking and from offering to the slave her blood that he might stanch its flow. The conflict lay in her role as mistress. On the one hand, it was frightful to her so to speak and to offer him her flesh and blood in exchange for his own, while on the other, it was her fitting part to behave as the male and, so to speak, as the bearded, active principal in love. Thus it was she bit her tongue by night above and below, so that it was nearly bitten through, and next day she lisped from the wound like a little child. For some days after the sending of the letter she would not see Joseph, but denied him her countenance because she could not look into his after challenging him in writing to try a fall. But just this renunciation of his presence it was that made her ripe to utter with her own lips what she had said in magic writing. The longing for his presence took the form of the longing to utter the words which it was forbidden to him, the slave of love, to speak. For if she were ever to learn whether he spoke from his soul, there was nothing left but for her, the mistress, to speak and to offer him her flesh and blood in the fervent hope that she responded to his own desire and took the words from his lips. Her role as mistress condemned her to shamelessness, for which she had already punished herself at night by biting her tongue, so that now she might take leave to say what she must say, as well as she could after the punishment, lisping like a child, which was also a refuge, since it gave an air of helplessness and innocence to the shamelessness, and turned into pathos what would else have been gross. She had summoned Joseph through Dudu to a business session and a game afterwards, and she received him in the hall with the image of Atum about an hour after the meal, when Joseph would have finished reading to Potiphar. She came to him from her bedchamber, and as she approached, he made the observation for the first time, or for the first time consciously, that she was greatly changed. I also have until this hour refrained from notice of the change which had taken place since the beginning of her passion, and also as a result of it. It was a peculiar change, in characterizing and describing which I run the risk of being either offensive or misunderstood. To Joseph, when he at last perceived it, it afforded much food for wonderment and profound reflection, for life lies deep, not only in the spirit, but in the flesh. It was not that Mut had aged in this time. Her love would have prevented that. Had she grown more beautiful? Yes and no. But on the whole, no. Even decidedly no, if by beauty we mean the utterly admirable and satisfyingly complete, a splendid image, something glorious to enfold in one's arms, yet afterwards claiming no place in our thoughts, because it appeals to our most clarified sense, the eye, and not the mouth or the hand, in so far as it appeals to anything at all. For, however richly sensuous, beauty has about it something abstract and spiritual. It asserts its independence and the priority of the idea before the manifestation. It is not the product and tool of sex, but rather sex is its stuff and instrument. Feminine beauty. That may be beauty embodied in the feminine as beauty's means of expression. But if the relation between spirit and matter is reversed, so that one speaks of beautiful femininity rather than of feminine beauty, because the feminine has become the premise and primary idea, and the beauty its attribute, instead of the reverse, what then? What if sex, I would ask, deals with beauty as its material, embodying itself in it, so that beauty serves and is functional as a means of expressing the feminine? It is clear that the result is a quite different kind of beauty from that which I spoke of above, a suspect, an uncanny kind, which may even approach the ugly, and wield for evil the power over the emotions which it is the gift of beauty to wield, by virtue, that is, of sex, which has usurped beauty's place and takes its name. Then it is no longer a spiritual beauty revealed in the feminine, but a beauty in which the feminine reveals itself, an eruption of sex, the beauty of a witch. The word I have used, startling as it is indispensable to a description of the change which had taken place during the year in Moot's physical being. It was a change pathetic and disturbing at once, evil and apparent, a witch-like metamorphosis. We must not imagine a hag, we must reject such an idea, though perhaps a faint suggestion of something like it might enter in. A witch is certainly not of necessity hag-like, and yet in the most charming witch one might descry a trace. It does belong to the picture in our minds. Moot's new body was that of a witch, informed by love and sex, and thus remotely hag-like, though the only manifestation was a combined development of leanness and voluptuosity. A proper example of a hag was, for instance, Black Tabubu, who presided over the mysteries of the makeup and had breasts like wineskins. Moot's own breasts, once so tender and maidenly, had, thanks to her suffering, developed in voluptuous splendor, standing out like great fruits of love, and suggesting the hag-like only by comparison with the thinness, the emaciation of the fragile shoulder-blades. The shoulders themselves looked too narrow, fragile, even childishly touching, and the arms had lost much of their roundness. They were well-nigh thin. On the other hand, the thighs had developed, one might almost say, illicitly, by comparison with the upper extremities. They were large and vigorous, and gave the impression that they gripped a broomstick between them, over which the creature bent, with shrunken back and swelling breasts, and rode to the mountains. The fancy not only laid her hand, it fairly urged itself upon the observer, and the face helped it out, with its frame of black curls. That saddle-nosed, shadow-cheeked face, so long the theater of a conflict to which only now the right name can be given, since only now did it arrive at its climax. The quite witch-like contradiction between the stern, the threatening and sinister expression of the eyes, and the sinuous audacity of the deep-cornered mouth. This distressing contrast, now at its height, lent the face a morbid, mask-like tension, intensified probably by the burning smart of the bitten tongue. But among the reasons why she had bitten it was probably this, that she knew she would be obliged to lisp like an innocent child, and that the childlikeness of her lisping would perhaps disguise and palliate the witch aspect of her new body, of which she was but too well aware. We may guess the distress which the cause of all these changes felt at the sight of them. Now, for the first time, he began to realize how lightly he had behaved in paying no heed to the prayers of his pure-minded little friend, and instead of avoiding the mistress, let it come to this, that his swan maiden was transformed witch. The folly of his pedagogic schemes struck him. For the first time he had a glimmer of the fact that his behavior in the affair of his second life was not less culpable than his conduct toward the brethren. This insight, which was to ripen from a misgiving to a conviction, explains much that happened later. At first, his bad conscience and his distressful unease over the transformation of his mistress into a hag for love hid itself behind the special reverence, yes, veneration of his tone and manner. Wisely or unwisely, he proceeded, as on all other occasions, with his idiotic plan of pedagogic treatment, showed his rolls of accounts, and spoke of the supplies and consumption of various commodities for the house of women, the dismissing of certain servants, and the appointing of others. Thus he did not at once notice the injury to her tongue, for she only listened to him nervously and said almost nothing. But when they sat down to play their game at the beautifully carven board, she on her couch of ebony and ivory, he on an ox-legged tabouret, sorted the pieces shaped like couchant lions, and agreed upon the play, he could no longer fail, with mounting anxiety, to note that she lisped. When he had listened a few times and confirmed his perception, he ventured to ask, "What do I hear, my lady? It seems you have some difficulty in your speech." And he was forced to hear that the lady had pained in her tongue. She had hurt herself in the night and bitten her tongue. The steward must pay no heed. So she spoke. I reproduce the childish accents in our tongue instead of hers, but with no great difference to the effect. Joseph, profoundly shocked, lifted his hands from the board and wished not to play until she had tended her wound and taken balsam in her mouth, which Kun Anpu, the barber surgeon, must straightway be summoned to prepare. But she would not hear of it. She lightly reproached him that he wished to avoid the game, which at the beginning stood unfavorably for him, and it looked as though he would be pushed into the water. Therefore he would save himself by breaking up the game and seeking for the apothecary. In short, she held him to his seat, lisping and babbling like a child, for involuntarily she suited her words to the helplessness of her tongue, and spoke like a small girl, seeking to give her strained and suffering face an expression of infantine charm. I will not try to imitate her as she went on talking about puffing his pieces into the water, for I would not seem to mock at her who had death at her heart, and was in act to throw away every vestige of pride and spiritual honor in the overpowering urge to appease the honor of her flesh and see fulfilled the dream of healing which she had dreamed. He, too, who had awaked this urge in her, he, too, felt death at his heart, and only too justly. He did not dare to look up from the board, and he bit his lip, for his conscience spoke against him. Yet he played carefully. It would be hard to say whether reason controlled him, or he his reason. She too took her pieces, lifted and moved them, but so absently that she was soon in a corner with no way out, was hopelessly beaten without seeing it at all, but went on playing until she was recalled by the fact that he no longer moved, when she looked down with a nervous smile upon the confusion of her hopes. He, in his delusion, thought that by speaking sensibly and courteously he could mend the disordered situation and set it to rights. So he said discreetly, "We must try again, now or some other time, for the game went wrong, very likely because I made an awkward opening, and you see that we can get no further. You have checkmated me and I you, so that nobody has won or lost, for we have both done both." He hesitated, and his voice was toneless. He spoke on only because he had begun, for he could no longer hope to save the situation by speaking of it. Even as he spoke, the worst had happened. She had broken down, laying her head and face on his arm that rested on the edge of the board. Her hair, with its gold and silver powder, upset the couching lions, and her hot breath brushed his arm as she feverishly lisped and stammered. Out of respect for her pain, I refrained from reproducing the childish, sickly sounds, but their sense and nonsense ran somewhat like this. "Yes, yes, we can go no further. The play is played out. There is only a downfall for us both, O Sarsif. My beautiful god from afar, my swan and bull, my highly and hotly and eternally beloved. So we may die together, and go down into the darkness of blissful despair, Tell me, speak to me, and freely, since you cannot see my face because it lies upon your arm. At last upon your arm, and my lost lips touch your flesh and blood as I implore you. Tell me, not seeing my eyes, if you have had my letter that I wrote before I bit my tongue to prevent myself from saying what I wrote, and what I even so must say, because I am the mistress, and it lies with me to speak the word you may not speak and may not embolden yourself to utter, though the reason has long since become no reason. But I know not whether you would gladly say it, which is the sum of my anguish. For if I knew that you would burn to say it if you could, then I would take the words from your lips and blissfully utter them as your mistress, even though lisping and stammering, with my face hidden on your arm. Say, if you had my letter from the dwarf, as I wrote, and did you read it, were you glad to see my hand, so that all your blood rose in a wave to beat on your soul's shore? Do you love me, O Sarsif, my god in a slave's form, my sublime falcon, as I have loved you for so long, in bliss and torment? And does your blood burn for mine as mine for yours, so that I had to write the letter after long struggle, ensnared by the golden bronze of your shoulders and the love all bear you, but above all by the godlike glance beneath which my body has changed and my breasts become like fruits of love? Sleep with me. Give me your youth and splendor, and I will give you bliss undreamed of, for I know what I speak. Let us put our heads and our feet together for our delight, that we may together die of our mutual bliss. For no longer can I bear it that we live together as two.